That's when I punched him. Knocked him right off the Quai Lambladier and into the water. Not caring whether anybody saw and reported a public brawl or attempted drowning. Winley fought his way to the surface and climbed the brick walls of the man-made basin. I lost control and shouted at him.
You arrogant fuck! I was only there because of you! The mountains of shit I'm dealing with regarding the Norse are all due to that trip, and I only made it because I was trying to be loyal to you! Gods below, I put you back together after Thor pounded your head to gelatin, and then you betrayed me and got me involved in this vampire business! You cannot pretend you had no hand in escalating it, Leif said, scaling the wall. What does that have to do with your betrayal? When someone hits me, I hit back. So do I.
He coiled and sprang vertically over my head, tumbling once in the air and landing within striking distance. I hadn't enhanced my strength or speed, so I wasn't able to dodge or block his blow to my midsection. The air woofed out of me, and I staggered back, gasping for oxygen. He didn't follow up, but rather stripped off his jacket with disgust and whipped the sodden mess to the ground.
You have ruined this suit! Salt water contaminated with motor oil and the remains of many unlucky fish. Disgusting. Not that you care.
No, I don't.
I managed to say between gulps for air. With my breath returning, I said the words to increase my strength and speed. Enhanced by those bindings, I would be his physical equal, at least while the energy in my bear charm lasted. Leif knew from experience what I was doing, and smiled faintly, setting himself in a defensive position.
Theophilus was in Berlin, not Prague, I said, settling into a kung fu opening stance.
Yes, I heard.
Did I get him?
No. He yet lives. But you got some very old ones there, some older than me. Well done. He gave a few polite golf claps and smirked. And then we had us a fight.
Fast and brutal and skilled, like our old sparring sessions back in Arizona. Except that now I was genuinely angry and had limited resources available. I could neither afford to take my time or make costly sacrifices that I might make with the knowledge that I could heal it quickly. One thing I had learned from my old sessions with Leif was that it was useless to deliver body blows to a creature that did not depend on oxygen for energy. He never ran out of breath or stamina in the human sense, so those were a waste of time. Blows to the head could disorient him, however, and opening cuts above the eyes could blind him and make him more vulnerable. Though most of my blows got blocked or redirected, I did manage to plant a fist into his nose, and my elbow shattered a cheek. But he also knew my weakness. Body blows would drain me until I had to slow down, and then it would be over. I suffered a couple of cracked ribs from his hammer fists and lost my breath again to a knee in my gut. A lucky uppercut surprised him, and he lost his feet, landing heavily on his backside, shaking his head to clear it. I had almost nothing left in my tank, so I collapsed across from him and dispelled my bindings, ending it. I breathed heavily and bled on the quay, and Leif sat still, except for his face, which was noisily reconstructing itself. Since he had recently dined, he had plenty of energy for it. He wiped at the blood underneath his nose, looked surprised at how much there was on his sleeve, and then folded his legs underneath him. He dropped his head and shook it slowly as he spoke.
I know you will not believe me, but I have to say it anyway. In regard to Theophilus, I did not betray you.
Bullshit.
Drasha had me under surveillance. I thought my phone was secure, but obviously I was overconfident. Theophilus really was in Prague. But once Drasha heard you might be coming, he sent his lover to Berlin and set up an ambush for you at the Grand Bohemia. How could you possibly know that? Because I am not completely cut off from information. Nothing is volunteered to me anymore, But I do have several people under surveillance myself, and one of them happens to be working for Drasha. My people intercepted a call from Drasha to this individual, telling him to get his undead ass over to the hotel because you were on the way. Unfortunately, I was unable to warn you. Your old number did not work, and I left a voicemail with Hal Hauk, since he did not answer. Please, confirm with him. I would do that, but his excuse, at least, had the whiff of plausibility. I called Leaf using Ty's phone, so he didn't have my new number. And now? Where is Theophilus now, Leaf? At this precise instant, I cannot tell you. But I know where he will be soon enough.
Where?
What is that expression? All roads lead to Rome, I believe.
He'll be in Rome, where I've practically eliminated all the other old vampires. Why should I believe you this time when you've lied to me so often?
I did not lie about Prague. I guessed that he was there, which I made clear to you, and which also turned out to be a correct guess, and I am not lying about this. He must go and reclaim the city to have any legitimacy with the rest of the world's vampires. He considers the planet his empire, you know. But your guerrilla tactics have scattered us from our strongholds, driven us to hiding like rats in sewers, and as you saw, feeding on drunkards in alleys. I do not particularly mind, but he cannot countenance that.
I don't know. He ran away pretty quickly in Berlin. What makes you think he wants another confrontation?
Leaf chuckled. I am sure that running away stung him, and now he's working himself up to a real fight. He has had it too easy for too long, has he not? All vampires have. Remember Cymbeline? Plenty and peace breed cowards.
And hardness, ever of hardiness, is mother. Of course I remember it. But it doesn't follow that he'll go straight to Rome.
I think it does. I think he imagines all sorts of scenarios where he crushes you in Rome and finally frees the undead from the druidic threat. He must be the hero of all vampires, you see. His ego requires it. And my sources say it has been a couple of days, has it not, since your human have staked any vampires?
Yeah. Cash flow issues. Drosh's plan worked in that regard.
Then the proverbial coast is clear. He will retake Rome, and he will be bringing a small army with him to do it. He will wait for you to come get him, and this time he will be ready for human. He will have a plan.
All right, Leaf,
I said. Let's make a deal. Chapter 22. I have slept the slumber of the peaceful victor. And while a portion of my guilt remains, I believe I'm in a happy place. Even if I did it wrong, at least I finally did something about Beau Thatcher. Now it's in the past, and maybe I can leave it there and simply enjoy my cup of fulfillment. I'd like to think that I delivered some karma to my stepfather, rather than earned any bad karma of my own. It might be worthwhile to discuss it with Lakshya. She seems to have a heightened sensitivity to actions and their consequences now. Still, I cannot deny that I feel good. I've crossed off the biggest item on my life's to-do list, and now I feel like sharing it with someone. But I haven't heard from Atticus in a while. I text both him and Hal Hauk, but receive no answer. If Atticus got into any sort of trouble over the past couple of weeks, and he almost certainly did, he's probably switched to a new phone, and I'll need to wait for him to text me. And he won't, unless he's truly worried. He's sweet about giving me my space.
But now that I can be with him without worrying that I'm showing Loki precisely where to find him and Oberon, I'd love to hook up again. The thing is that if I can't reach him via cell phone, and also have no ability to divine him, thanks to Cold Iron, he can be pretty difficult to find. Perhaps the Sisters of the Three Auroras might have ideas. If I ask them where the crazy, magical stuff is happening in the world, they might be able to pin that down. And wherever that is, I'll probably find Atticus. And if not, maybe it will turn out to be something that requires a druid's attention anyway. There's another reason to visit Warsaw. I've read a few of those poems by Wisława Szymborska now. Nothing Twice is fabulous, and so is Theater Impressions. She's definitely my kind of poet. And I think it's time to learn Polish. Delivering that news will be welcome to the sisters, I'm sure, and make the trip worthwhile, even if they're not able to help otherwise. I will most likely spend quite a bit of time with the sisters in the near future, if they're comfortable with it. I discover, once we're in Tir na n'Og and searching for spots, that there are no bound trees closer to Malina Sokołowska's house than the black poplar in Pola Mokotowskia. I might need to fix that if I'm going to visit them more frequently. They have stands of pine trees nearby that would work just fine. The jog to Radosht is pleasant, though. It's early afternoon in Warsaw when we arrive, and the streets are not terribly crowded between lunch and the rush hour home. The gate to Malina's property is open, and Evelina is sitting cross-legged on the ground outside the gate, smoking a cigarette. She flicks it into the hard-packed gravel of the street and rises, grinning when she sees me.
Hello, Granue.
Devil horns.
Rakan.
She pushes the gate open wider and invites Orla and me to enter. Dominika immediately bounds out of the house and almost slips on the mossy steps as Evelina closes the gate behind us.
Whoops! Granuel, you're here! Come with me and talk to Miłosz.
She grabs my arm and yanks me around the side of the house.
Oh, okay. What's the hurry? Is something wrong? I think he's sad. Will you talk to him for me?
Sure. I smile faintly behind Dominika's back. While I hope it's nothing serious, I also doubt it's anything but her imagination. It's wonderful to see that Miłosz has someone to worry about him, though. He will be pampered instead of neglected now. He has his nose in a bag of oats when we clear the corner of the house. Switching over my vision and binding my mind to his, I greet him and ask if he is well. He lifts his head out of the bag and nickers at me in recognition. He answers that he is mostly content. Is anything wrong? His reply is that he'd like to go for walks instead of being in the same area all the time. A request that sounds simple enough and certainly understandable, but somewhat fraught with risk, since Loki wants him back. The mark on his hide hasn't been burned away, and I don't think I could bear to hurt him to get rid of it with the Rune of Ashes. Besides, I think the sisters are almost hoping Loki makes a move to get him, but I think they want him to make that move here, where they have all their wards in place. I tell Miłosz I'll see what I can do about that, and then relay his wishes to Dominika. He just wants to go for walks.
Oh,
she bites her lip.
We want to be able to protect him as well.
What if all of you accompanied him, the entire coven, as opposed to simply you? Change up the times and routes so they're not predictable, but be aware that an attack could come at any time.
Yeah, tell him we'll figure something out.
Dominika's and Miwash's worries temporarily relieved, I accept the invitation to baked goods this time and enter Melina's house. There's no old-world kitsch inside. It's spare, modern, and minimalist, with a focus on large oil canvases and small bronze sculptures celebrating femininity. I'm given tea and cake and chit-chat from the witches in attendance. Only half the coven is here. The news that I'd like to tackle Szymborska and the Polish language is well-received. And after that, I judge it would be a good time to ask for a wee favor, couched as an effort to help the coven. I address the leader. Listen, Melina, I'd like to find Atticus and ask him about the vampire situation, among other things, but he's been out of touch, and I'm not sure how to locate him at the moment. Might you have any idea how to do that? She blinks at me and says, "His cold iron aura shields him from our sight.
He's cloaked every bit as much as you are.
Oh, I know. But I thought we could be clever about it and search for where the ruckus is.
What do you... Are you talking about something specific? If so, maybe we could find it. Could you describe the ruckus?
No, it's not specific. I simply think that whatever you find will be vampire-related.
We have trouble divining the undead as well.
Yes, but I thought that by now they would have recruited a few magical allies. Atticus has been paying some fae to assassinate them, and they've been quite effective. I think the vampires might start paying magic users of their own for protection. So I suppose what I'm saying is, wherever you detect that a large magical signature has flared up recently, that's where Atticus will be. And if he's not, well, maybe a large magical signature deserves my attention anyway.
Melina taps her index finger on the granite kitchen countertop a few times, considering.
Her eyes travel around the room, taking in the witch's present. There are six in all, and she nods.
Okay. It's worth a try if it gets us closer to a vampire-free Poland. There are some here in Warsaw, and a few others preying on students in Poznan that we particularly do not enjoy. Anna, will you remain here and give Granuel her first Polish lesson? The rest of us will try to find the equivalent of a magical ruckus.
As the other sisters file out to the back acreage, Anna does a little Muppet flail in her excitement to teach me her language. She grabs a pad and pen and starts with the alphabet and sounds. I've always liked the letter Z, so discovering that Polish has three versions, Z, C, and G, confirms that I've made the right choice. Time slips by in language acquisition over tea, until Melina and the others return. I notice they have little moonshine yarrow blossoms in their hair.
Rome, Melina says without preamble. You need to go to Rome.
Why? What's happening there?
Something very strange is going on in the Piazza di Spagna. I'd say it's almost Rosicrucian, except it feels a bit off.
I don't know what you mean by that.
The short version is that there are powerful wards around some of the buildings there. But they're unusually constructed. They're probably traps. I wouldn't simply walk in there to see what happens.
And these are recent?
Yes. We haven't sensed anything like this before.
Okay, I say, getting up.
Orla rises with me and wags her tail.
I'm on it.
Be extremely careful, Granuel. Call us if you want to talk about it once you take a closer look.
All right, will do.
I thank Anna for the language lesson and take my leave, jogging back to Pola Mokotowskia with Orla. I teach her the names for Italian charcuterie on the way, with the result that she can't wait to try prosciutto and culatello and salama di sugo ferraresi.
We'll see what we find first once we get to Rome. A deli or Atticus and Oberon?
Chapter 23. Funerals are a bit fancy now, I notice, since everyone dresses in the best black clothing they have. In my own day, you had one set of clothes, two if you were doing well, and you washed them when you got tired of the dirt and the bugs on your balls, not because somebody died. But Greta gets me some proper morning clothes, because that's a sign of respect, she says. So I go along because Hal feckin' deserves all the respect I can give. Now Gwy do, of course, who entrusted his family to me. It's really a hastily arranged memorial service instead of a funeral. Hal left instructions to be buried in Iceland, and Ner Gwy is to be returned to Mongolia. But the idea is the same. You remember the fallen, and share why they were important to ye, and give what comfort ye can to the family. Even if it's feckin' useless, and your words can't possibly mend the hole torn open in their world, and the yawning abyss of the future without their loved one. People still need to know that she would fix everything if he could. Since Greta came back, she hasn't said very much, beyond we'll talk later, and a few grunts. I don't have to cast wands to guess that it won't be a pleasant dock. And I admit me guts are in a twist about it. Since I got pulled back into this time, the only thing that's kept me from throwing shite at people is Greta. I know that when you think of love, you're supposed to think of kissy faces and scented soap and humming happy songs together. But there's another vital part to it that people rarely admit to themselves. We want somebody to rescue us from other people. From talking to them, I mean. Or from the burden of giving a damn about what they say. We don't want to be polite and stifle our farts now, do we? We want to let them rip, and we want to be with someone who won't care if we do, who will love us regardless and fart right back besides. I'm thinking that maybe Greta could be that person for me. Or she could have been, until a feckin' vampire showed up. The entire Tempe pack is driven up for the memorial on Greta's land, and I think the plan is they're going to do a run in the mountains later tonight for Al, with most, if not all, of the Flagstaff pack joining them for Nurgui, and the next full moon will be dedicated to them as well. I hear dark mutterings that the vampires will be paying for this. Meg and Tui are going to stay, which surprises me. Nergui and Meg both wanted their daughter to be a druid, and Meg hasn't changed her mind about it. They're going to take care of things in Mongolia for a while, and then they'll be back. I keep my face shut during the memorial. I didn't know Hal or Nergui half so well as the rest, and this is a pack thing, if anything is. There are some interesting noises made at werewolf memorials. Half barks and yips and growls, plus faces sliding around as they fight to keep hold of their emotions and their human forms. Nobody completely loses it, though. Afterward, Greta crooks a finger at me, and we walk off some distance into the trees before she speaks. She has a black veil over her eyes, but the cold blue of them still seizes me when she looks up. Her voice is tight and controlled and distant. She's wearing a man's suit and tie in silver, which has some kind of symbolism to the pack. Out of the inside jacket pocket, she withdraws the plastic bag that Hal brought with Sheehan's new documents in it. She tosses it to me and then spits to the side. I want you to find him and tell him he's not welcome here anymore. He's not welcome among any members of the Tempe or Flagstaff packs. And yes, I speak for Sam and Ty in this. She waits for me to say something. But if she's expecting an argument, she's going to be disappointed. Okay, I said. I wouldn't ask you to never speak to him again. But I cannot stress how much we are tired of his shit. Now, tired isn't a word. Furious. Enraged, ready to destroy him. That's closer. We do not want our pack to be collateral damage in his endless series of crises, so henceforth, we will have no association with him whatsoever. I don't know what collateral damage is, so I just nod and look it up later. Greta takes that as her cue to continue.
If you wish to meet with him, do so, far away from here. How he gets in touch with you must be mundane as well, no fey messengers. He needs to use either mail or social media. I will help you with that if you need it.
All right. I am so relieved that she's not sending me packing over this that I can't manage anything else.
No favors, no more IDs. His legal relationship with Magnuson and Hauk is terminated, and they will serve papers to that effect. No watching his hound or his sword, which Sam and Ty brought to the service, by the way, and you're to take with you. It's waiting in the house on the dining room table. So nothing from now on. He may live in peace outside our territory, but if he is stupid enough to enter it again, we will do whatever we can to end his very long life. Is that clear?
Absolutely. Tension drains out of her shoulders, and she exhales slowly and closes her eyes. She had said what she wanted to say.
Good. Do you have any questions?
I don't suppose maybe the law firm has any idea where he is. Maybe I can get this over with quickly. She shakes her head.
My guess would be Rome, but I don't know. Can't the Fae find him?
Nah, he made sure the Fae couldn't find him a long time ago. Why Rome?
If he's truly trying to break the vampires, then that's where he'll be. He might have done something there already, and that's why we got hit.
All right, Rome it is. Worth a look. Any place specific in Rome?
Wherever the rich people are living now. Prestige, wealth, power. The old vampires like to let everyone know they have it.
Right. I'll get a couple of things together and go. I think about kissing her goodbye, but I'm not sure she would welcome it. I give her a tight nod instead, and turn back to the house. After a few steps I hear a move, and it's fast. I don't get to turn around before arms are around me, hugging me from behind. I stay still, and she rests her head between my shoulder blades.
Thank you, Owen, she says.
No need for thanks, I reply. I want the new grove protected every bit as much as you want to protect the park. And the solution is the same. Keep Sheahan the feck away from here. She doesn't respond to this, except to squeeze a little harder. This could be fast, but it could also be days or weeks before I catch up with him. And I'm pretty sure I'll have to help him with the vampires, if he has an endgame. So explain to the kids and the parents, will you, why I'm gone. And that I'll be back when it's finished. I don't want this to happen again.
No, we definitely do not want that.
She lets go, only to spin me around to face her and bring her hand up to the side of me face. Those eyes hold mine through the veil.
Be ruthless and thorough. And don't worry about us. We'll be here.
Good. I nod. She lets me go, and I return to the house. Greta stays in the trees. I grab me knuckles and Fragra from the dining room table, and I also pick up those steaks that Lukta made for us. One for me, and one for Granuel, in case I find her with Sheehan. I don't know how the pack stands in regards to her, and I don't want to bring it up until it's necessary. Better to let her decide if she wants to have a separate status from Sheehan, or throw in her lot with him. I know what I want. Greta and Owen's Grove, allowed to live in peace. There's harmony there to be found, and I'll fight for it. And damn the paradox of fighting for peace.
Chapter 24. It feels a bit like parachuting behind enemy lines, shifting into Rome. Here, Theophilus and his old nest of vampires manipulated Julius Caesar and the others that followed him into attacking the continental druids, and their campaigns, combined with the spread of Christianity, effectively wiped us out. He thought he'd won. I suppose he did. When you wait 2,000 years before launching a counterattack, you cannot truly say you're fighting the same war. My visits to Rome throughout the centuries had always been brief affairs, for art appreciation, just day trips, when the vampires would be asleep. But I made sure that I always kept the tether updated. It's located on the northern edge of Rome, in Villa Borghese, a large estate that was home to an old family with close ties to several popes. Today it's partially public land, with a zoo and expansive parks. It'll be a reliable gateway to Rome for a long time to come, and it's conveniently located close to the Piazza di Spagna, where Leif suggested to me that I might find Theophilus.
He had a flat right on the piazza, and so did several others of the leadership. Bought them for a song centuries ago, bequeathed them to their new identities once a generation, as you have no doubt done with your own assets. And now they are worth millions of euros each,
because the location has become so desirable.
It wasn't always so? I asked.
No. When Keats and Shelley lived there, it was marked as the English ghetto. So cheap that poor foreign poets could afford a room. I know for a fact that your Fey assassins dispatched a couple of the vampire leadership there. Theophilus will want to reclaim those flats for symbolic reasons.
You mean he'll buy them?
Eventually. He and his entourage will charm their way in for the short term, while they work on making everything legal. If they want a flat and find it occupied, they can kill the owner and make it available.
He has the money to pay for these?
Almost certainly. Remember, in addition to his own considerable wealth, thanks to Werner Drascher, he has all your money to play with now. He'll spend it quickly just to spite you.
When I arrived at the Piazza di Spagna, so named for its proximity to the Spanish embassy, not because the Spanish had anything to do with building or designing the plaza. It was not so crowded as one finds during the high tourist season. The unusually cold weather encouraged tourists to spend their time indoors at museums or churches. I walked with Oberon to the boat-shaped fountain designed by Bernini at the bottom of the Spanish steps, enjoyed the beauty of it for a while, and thought seriously about going into Babington's tea rooms on the left side of the steps for some tea that would be ridiculously overpriced, but would at least have the benefit of being hot. Bereft of euros, though, I'd have to wait. First, I wanted to test Leif's assertion that Theophilus and company had taken up residence in the flats ringing the piazza. The giveaway would be armed thralls standing guard outside the residences with firearms and shoulder holsters and earpieces in their ears. But I didn't want to announce my presence any earlier than necessary. I began with a casual scan of the buildings in the magical spectrum to see if anything jumped out at me. I expected nothing, but something most definitely jumped up and down for my attention. Three buildings opposite Babington's were sheathed in wards of some kind. Those weren't something a vampire could do, so they must have been put in place by a paid magical contractor. And that contractor might well remain nearby. They were all 5 or 6 stories high, with the bottom 2 floors devoted to high-end retail and the upper stories divided into flats. From left to right, they housed shop fronts for Pucci, Gazzadei, Jaeger-LeCoultre, and Dolce & Gabbana, though a large doorway allowed access to interior stairwells and elevators. To get to them, I'd have to cross the threshold of those wards, and I wasn't ready to do that. Above the fashion shops, rows of windows checkered the facade. Most of them shuttered closed, but a few thrown open to let in the weak winter sun. The open windows provided a big clue to where the vampires were not. Looking up, I could see the green umbrellas of boxed trees and hints of rooftop gardens, lofty areas for the obscenely rich to gaze down upon the hoi polloi. Keeping my magical sight active, I urged Oberon to take a circuit of the block with me. I wanted to know if the wards protected all sides of the buildings. While the structures all shared walls, with no alleys between them, they were easily identifiable by the paint jobs. The Pucci building was a sort of sun-washed mauve. Gazzadei occupied a terracotta building, and the third and largest was a yellow cream color. And a circuit of the block down narrow cobbled streets confirmed that they were in fact warded on all sides. I was careful not to break the boundary of the wards or let Oberon stray too close. They were of unfamiliar origin, and I wasn't sure what they would do. I shouldn't let my eagerness to slay Theophilus lead me into a foolish mistake. Around the backside of the buildings, in a narrow street filled with glove shops, handbag hawkers, and jewelry stores, a pair of pickpockets made the foolish mistake of trying to work me. I didn't have a wallet, for one thing. They looked like brother and sister. The girl made appreciative noises over Oberon and tried to occupy my attention by leaning over him and letting her loose-fitting blouse fall away. It was impossible that she was unconscious of this. For one thing, it was too cold for such clothing, so she was obviously trying to distract me. Meanwhile, her partner or brother kept moving past me, and then circled back around. When I felt his fingers dip into my back pocket, I dropped and swept his legs. He landed on the cobbled stones hard, and then I spun and pinned him, fishing a few bills out of his pocket. The girl shouted at me, and then tried to discourage me by calling for help. I let the boy up and grinned at them both. "You targeted the wrong man," I said in Italian. "Run along now. I know you don't truly want the police to look into this." Without being prompted, Oberon laid back his ears and growled at them. They took off, but cursed me soundly. I thanked them for the lunch money. The few passers-by who had seen the altercation had no trouble with me. Apparently, pickpockets were common in the area, and they gave me a couple of bravos. We completed the circuit of the block, returned to the piazza, and I slipped into Babington's for some picnic food to go. They sold such things even in winter, because the days were usually much milder than this. We sat on the Spanish steps, a good distance above the tourists collected around Bernini's fountain, and Oberon wagged his tail at a steady stream of people who wanted to pet him as they passed.
"People cannot resist me, Atticus. Are you seeing this? I am the most interesting hound in the world."
"That's indisputable, buddy."
"But is that another hound down there?"
He got to his feet and stared off toward the north end of the plaza.
"It is? Oh, I think it's Orla. Yes! And there's Clever Girl."
I followed his gaze and saw a familiar red head and a staff. I grinned, stood, and called to get her attention. She waved back, and the hounds ran to meet each other in the middle.
"Atticus, I ate all my food already and don't have any to give Orla. What do I do?"
"Don't worry, we'll get some for her." "Hey, nice jacket," Granny Whale said, smiling at me as she climbed the steps. But then she halted, cocked her head, and the smile disappeared. Her arm raised, and she pointed, waggling her finger around.
"Whoa, what the hell? What happened to your little Mini Cooper beard?"
My hand drifted up to my chin.
"Oh, I had to be Nigel in Toronto. Don't worry, I'll grow it back."
"You actually went to Toronto? Ooh, sounds like a story. I expect we have plenty to catch up on."
She smiled once more and came up the steps, arms wide.
"Come here."
Gods, it was good to see her. It was a pretty joyful reunion, having her in my arms again. I hadn't seen her since Hal Houck gave me the news about Kodiak Black's death, and we did indeed have plenty of catching up to do. I watched the hounds on the steps while she visited Babington's to pick up some munchies for herself and Orla. Orla had been looking forward to charcuterie once she got to Rome, but since Oberon was there to play with, and I promised she'd get the good stuff eventually, she wasn't too upset about settling for a picnic selection of salami and cheese. Granuaile had been busy while we were apart. Fjallar had removed, or rather burned away, Loki's mark, and then she secured a divination cloak from the Sisters of the Three Auroras by fetching Sventovit's horse from under the guard of Veles.
"I'll be spending more time with the sisters," she said. "I'm going to learn Polish from my new headspace and memorize Szymborska's poetry."
That was surprising.
"Wow, I'm envious because I never learned Polish. But if you're wanting another headspace for plane shifting..."
"Why not memorize something in Latin or Russian?"
Granuaile finished.
"Yeah."
"Because I want beautiful stuff in my head. If I put the Russian lit I've read so far into permanent memory, I think it would sour my sunny disposition."
"Fair enough," I said. "But at risk of souring it now, I should tell you that Fjallar's dead."
"What? How did that happen?"
"Briat killed him. He was leading an army against the Dark Elves, and he wouldn't talk to us. Odin had told him to march on Svartalfheim, and so he did, and Briat made him an example."
"Damn. So that was what they were talking about. They hinted that they might be going to Svartalfheim while I was in Asgard."
"It's all under a happy treaty now. But I think that Odin, and maybe even Briat, the more that I think about it, engineered the whole situation to make the Dark Elves come to the table. It was cold-blooded and Machiavellian, but in retrospect, probably necessary. They weren't very willing to talk at first. The Morgan said we needed them on our side, and now they are. The bonus is that the Dark Elves promise never to take a contract out on us again.
Hey, that's good news.
Especially since Fand escaped. Did you know about that?
No, when was this?
A few days ago. But hopefully that'll be someone else's problem. We're both shielded from her divination now, and I know where she is. I'm going to tell Briette and let her take care of it. I have enough on my plate as it is. I told her about my run-ins with Werner Drascha, and how my attempt on Theophilus in Berlin was a near miss. Also that Diana was free of her prison, but still supremely pissed at us. She made an oath to leave us alone, and broke it immediately. Jupiter said he'd keep her from pursuing us from now on, but we'll see.
So what's on the agenda here? Granuelle asked. Did I catch you on a break? Or have you even started any shit yet?
I was casing the joint, I explained, then pointed to the warded buildings. Look at those buildings in the magical spectrum. They have some strange wards on them. She did, and then turned to me.
Yeah. Melina said there was something odd going on at the piazza. Said those wards are as much traps as they are for protection.
Ah, I was wondering how you found me here. Yeah, I just asked where the weird was happening in the world, and she pointed me here. And look, you're right next to it.
Very clever. Did she say anything else about those wards?
Yes, she said they looked kind of Rosicrucian, but different somehow.
Rosicrucian? Shit.
What? Why is there shit?
Hey, well, it wasn't me,
Oberon said, panic in his voice.
Me neither,
Orla chimed in. Hounds never want to be blamed when shit happens. We reassured them that we were speaking figuratively, and did not suspect for an instant that they were to blame. Once they went back to nipping each other's ears and getting petted by passers-by, I explained in a low voice to Granuelle why I was worried.
Rosicrucians have a long and occasionally dark history.
Are you already familiar with them?
I've heard the term before, but don't know very much about them.
They're a secret society that began in the early 15th century. They influenced Freemasonry and plenty of other societies that pledged themselves on their face to the betterment of society, but kept their methods for achieving that behind closed doors. Some of them, I should say many of them, were genuinely trying to make things better. And I think that they did, in some cases. They had a philosophy and despised the corruption of the Catholic Church, and they thought their mucking about with the mysteries of the universe was entirely honorable. We still have some Rosicrucian orders scattered about today, or other secret societies that claim no formal ties but were clearly influenced by them.
The thing is, some of these groups, or rather offshoots of them, were cauldrons of evil, you know?
Dudes made up their own secret societies and wore the term Rosicrucian to give them respectability, but underneath that lurked horrors, like a syphilitic dick hidden under a blanket. They would say they were dedicated to the sciences, but that really meant that they were pursuing alchemy and trying to learn dark secrets.
You remember that Werner Drosch's powers were given to him by an alchemist, and that he later killed his creator, so to speak.
Well, I got a good look at his tattoos back in Toronto. On the very top of his pate, in amongst the alchemical symbols, was a rose cross.
Oh, so some kind of Rosicrucian bad seed created the arcane life leech?
Yes. And it's a safe bet that these Rosicrucian wards are going to be nasty. In fact, given that they most likely exist to protect Theophilus, and we know of his connection to Werner Drascha, we can practically guarantee it. Let me throw another name at you. Ever heard of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn?
Golden Dawn? Yeah. Wasn't that the group with Bram Stoker, William Butler Yeats, and Aleister Crowley?
Yes. They were influenced by Rosicrucian mysteries as well. Very much into that. As well as into Hermetic Kabbalism.
Hermetic Kabbalah? As opposed to Jewish Kabbalah?
Yes, a different system. More syncretic with other traditions. But their ceremonies still have the Tree of Life as their basis, so if you're going to do something major, like Ward 3 buildings, you probably need more than one person working on it.
Meaning there might be a bunch of Rosicrucians nearby.
Exactly. Let's take a closer look at those wards. We descended the steps and crossed the piazza to examine the wards, hounds trailing behind us. In the magical spectrum, we saw points of light in what appeared to be a random distribution, but after our recent conversation, I was able to spy a pattern.
Look here, Granuel, I said, pointing near the boundary of the ward, but being careful not to touch it.
I traced my finger in a lightning pattern.
See this? 10 points on the Tree of Life. And interlocking with it on all sides are more trees.
It's a Kabbalistic ward. The hermetic kind, I'm guessing.
Yes, I see, but what does it do?
That I do not know. We can see people going in and out of the stores here without a problem. I'm betting that it's a ward specifically to mess with druids. And I'm nervous about it because I remember when the Hammers of God confronted me in Tempe and essentially cut off my ability to bind anything. So I'm not anxious to stick my finger into this particular socket.
Well, you told me that you're on better terms with the Hammers of God now after Toronto. Why not give them a call and see if they can take this down? I mean, we don't absolutely have to go after the vampires today, right? We can wait for a bit of help.
Yes, that's an outstanding idea. I pulled out my new burner phone and punched in Rabbi Yosef Bialik's number from memory. He answered in a sleepy voice. It's not early afternoon in Toronto, but rather closer to 6 in the morning. Hello, Rabbi? Atticus here. How soon can you and your friends get to Rome?
Chapter 25. After Atticus convinces the rabbi to fly to Rome as soon as he can, we have the rest of the day and a night to kill. It's just as well. Neither of us is 100% healthy, still recuperating after our assorted run-ins with gods and the undead. We decide to shift elsewhere before the vampires wake up for the night, but we take our time returning to the Villa Borghese. We make a date out of it, visiting a charcuterie to fulfill my promise to Orla and delight Oberon in the process. I'm not super familiar with Rome. I had to get instructions to find the Piazza di Spagna. So Atticus shows me a few things, and we get espressos at one of the ubiquitous café bars that pepper the city the way Starbucks peppers Seattle. I love the clink of saucers and cups, and the gurgling hiss of steam wands frothing milk over the music of the Italian language. When we get to the Villa Borghese, it's about an hour before dusk, and as we're walking to the tethered tree, we see a familiar figure walking toward us.
Oi! Well, at last finding ye wasn't the nightmare I expected,
a deep, growly voice says.
Didn't have to take a single step onto that dead land.
Hello, Owen, Atticus says. We were just about to leave. What are you doing here?
Looking for you? I have news, good and bad, and some of your bollocks.
He tosses Fragorot to Atticus in its scabbard, and the leather strap flaps in the air. Then he tosses a plastic bag to him, which Atticus catches and examines.
Oh, my new documents. Thanks. It'll be good to have a bank account again. Huh. Connor Malloy. Not bad.
The Archdruid's face twists into an ugly sneer, and he spits to one side.
The good news is that Werner Drosch is finally dead. Greta killed him.
Oh, wow, that is good news.
But wait, are you saying Werner Drosch was in Flagstaff?
That's exactly what I'm feckin' saying to you, lad. And before Greta killed him, but very shortly after Hal Hauk brought your documents there and raised a toast to your bloody arse, Werner Drosche brought 7 vampires with him and shut up our house. Now, why do you suppose he'd do a thing like that?
Oh, no. I bet it was retaliation for Berlin.
What's Berlin?
A city in Germany. I unbound 19 old friends of Theophilus there, but he escaped. He must have told Drosch to strike back however he could.
So he hopped on a plane and came straight for us.
I guess so. Was anyone hurt?
Owen's fists clench at his sides, and he shouts,
Yes! Someone got hurt! Hal Hawk is dead, ye feckin' shite heap, because of you. He was there to deliver your new identity, and then he took a silver bullet to the brain because of something you did in Berlin, and the father of one of my apprentices was killed too.
Atticus shrinks back under the onslaught. It's awful, terrible news, and I see that it hits him hard, especially since it was delivered with such a large load of blame. "Oh, gods," he says. "What can I do? Is there a service to be held, or..."
"It's been held already. I just came from there, and I have a message to deliver from the pack. Pax, I mean, both Tempe and Flagstaff. You're banished, lad. If ye enter their territory again, they'll try to kill ye. They're not gonna hunt ye or set the world's pax on your tail, but ye can't ever go back. And Magnuson and Hawk won't be your firm anymore after they finish what business they have with ye. Time to get some new attorneys."
"What?" I say. "Wait, that's..."
"Completely deserved," Atticus says. "I understand their point of view on this. I don't blame them."
"Well, they shouldn't be blaming you either," I said. "It's not like you pulled the trigger."
"No, but I gave Drosh a reason to go there. They're perfectly justified." His voice has gone cold and dead, and I know what he's doing. He's walling up his pain in a different headspace. But at least it's calming down Owen, who looked for a moment as if he would throw a punch. He looks up at his old Arc Druid and says, "Thanks for letting me know, and bringing me my sword." Owen merely grunts in reply and turns to me.
"Speaking of weapons, I have something for you too, Grunuel."
I immediately assume it's a parting gift and gasp,
"What? Am I banished too?"
"Not that I've heard. I imagine they won't jump to do you any favors, but I don't think they'd go after you either. No, what I have is a stake carved by Lukta."
He's dressed in jeans and a soft brown leather coat lined with lamb's wool. He pulls out a hardwood stake, beautifully carved, and tells me it'll unbind a vampire no matter where you stab it.
"Sheehan and I each have one as well."
"It works," Atticus assures me. "Lukta's a genius." "Thank you," I say, taking it from Owen's hand. "It's well balanced, and I might be able to throw it. I'd have to experiment first."
"Right,"
the Arc Druid says, clapping his hands together.
"How can I help ye stop this vampire shite?"
Atticus is surprised at first, but doesn't reject the offer. "We can't do anything until tomorrow. We need to catch up anyway. Let's shift to a place I know almost directly south of here. It'll be a warm night and keep us in the same time zone. Follow me." He and Oberon shift planes, leaving a binding to trace him through Tir na n'Og and thence to a cliffside view of an ocean with a sandy beach below. The sun is low on the horizon and painting a bank of clouds orange and pink.
"Warm here,"
Orla says, and she and Oberon immediately get involved in a game of chase now that there's room for them to stretch their legs.
"Ah, nice. Where's this then?"
Owen asks when he appears behind me at the tethered tree. Atticus gives a tiny grin. "Welcome to Gauta Beach in Benguela, Angola. No one's going to bother us here. We should be able to relax and recharge." We pick our way down off the cliff, and the water in the bay is an attractive blue-green. A lonely fishing boat is parked so far offshore it appears to be a little more than a flattened buoy. The sand is warm without scorching, and we have this isolated stretch of the beach to ourselves. I don't think Atticus or Owen wants to continue talking about Hal, or being banished, and it's probably too soon to battle plan for tomorrow, so I flail about for a safe topic. The hounds splash into the ocean and play in the tide while we take seats in the sand.
"Let's think ahead for a minute, Atticus. Owen's going to be training his apprentices from now on, but what are we going to do if we get to the other side of this vampire problem?"
He squints at me in the sun.
"Well, we'll live in Oregon, I suppose."
"I know that, but what will we do? Because I want to defend the Earth."
He cocks his head to the side.
"Aren't you already doing that?"
"I mean actively defend it from pollution, clean it up, tip the climate back towards something that won't kill us all, restore balance after centuries of unsustainable exploitation."
"That sounds impossible to me. like taking up the labor of Sisyphus and expecting the boulder to stay at the top of the hill for you when it never would for him. Just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. For a moment, I'm taken aback, but then I recover. No, Atticus, that argument is what you use when you're talking about crazy shit, like eating brains or fucking a goat. Owen interrupts to say,
I tried to tell him that centuries ago, but he didn't listen.
I don't want to go there, not least because it would distract me from making my point. So I continue as if the Archdruid hadn't spoken. That's not a valid argument when you're a druid talking about defending Gaia. The right thing for us to say is, I should fight despoiling the Earth because I truly can. We should be trapping carbon and forcing the petroleum and coal industries to gasp out their final blackened breaths. He appears genuinely perplexed by my reasoning. But that's not why Gaia made druids. She's going to be fine and continue to exist, whether humans are here or not. She allowed humans to be bound to the Earth to protect elementals from magical exploitation, not mundane wear and tear. The rising sea levels and mass extinctions are hardly mundane wear and tear, and industrial-level contamination didn't exist 5,000 years ago, so of course that wasn't on Gaia's mind. Atticus shrugs like it's not important.
I think it's a waste of time.
Well, I think it's the best possible use of it.
Oh, are you going to get into a fight?
Owen says, a hopeful note in his voice.
My nipples are getting hard already.
This clearly isn't the safe topic I'd been hoping for, but now that I'm in it, I can't stop. So you want to live in Oregon and just do nothing? What I do isn't nothing. I've been on call for the world's elementals for 2,000 years. I have plenty of tethers to mend, new ones to make, and a fortune to rebuild. But that's it? You don't want to do anything to help? I help every time an elemental asks for it. I know, Atticus, but I'm talking about your love for the Earth and the desire to help even when it's not asked for. It was never really an option for me before now, he says. If I used magic, I'd be sending a beacon to Angus Og, telling him where to find me. That threat is gone now, but I'm still not in a place where I can think about this as a realistic occupation. I mean, you could spend your whole day at it, and then what would you do to buy your hound a steak? Owen interjects again, but this time he's not mocking, but correcting.
That's poor thinking there, lad. You let your hound hunt. There's nobody who can live off the land better than druids. You don't need these modern economic bollocks, and you know it.
That's true, Atticus. You'll own the Oregon property free and clear, and we won't require much else, except maybe beer money. What is this? Are you guys tag-teaming me?
I don't know what a tag-team is, but we're not attacking you, lad. Honest now. You said it yourself. For too long it was just you, and you couldn't do a damn thing but survive. But now it's different. And you should consider how your duty might have changed with the times.
It's not that different yet, Atticus replies. I'm still just trying to survive.
As are we all. Perhaps it's premature to be thinking of the future. I can't be speaking for Granuel, so I'll say my own advice is to avoid falling into your old patterns if we get past this vampire bit. Give the options a good think. As for me, I know what I'll be doing. Making more druids.
And I'll be doing everything I can to make dirty energy so expensive that people will flock to solar and wind. But I'll also get a day job in Poland, I think.
Really?
Atticus asks.
Why there?
To immerse myself in the language. And besides, I say, brightening at the thought, I like having beer money. I might even bartend again. Atticus drops his head, draws his knees up, and wraps his arms around them. His voice is low and muffled.
I remember going to Rulabula with Hal when you worked there. He was truly one of the good guys. Gods, I miss him already.
I should go ahead and admit it to myself. I'm terrible at choosing safe conversation topics.
Chapter 26.
When I woke up on the beach in Angola, Oberon curled against my side. I felt physically healed, but afflicted with an emotional malaise. Or to be more specific, an unholy horde of guilt ferrets.
They're bastards,